Hi, I'm Bill Kristol. Welcome back to Conversations. I'm very pleased to be joined here 2 days after Election Day in 2022, November 10th, by Ron Brownstein. We've done conversations after the elections of 2018 and 2020, and it did two before that, incidentally, which all of which people should go back and listen to, because they're all very revealing about American politics. But right after 2018, I think it was the weekend after, you predicted a Biden-Harris ticket in 2020. That was good.
Yeah, well,
we probably should have stopped.
Logic led there. You know, the primaries don't always follow logic, but in this case, they sort of did.
Anyway, Ron Brownstein is senior editor at The Atlantic, senior political analyst at CNN, one of the leading, in my view, analysts and most thoughtful and interesting analysts of American politics, but also American history, popular music, Rock Beyond the Water, his very well-received book about the 70s in L.A., is for sale at bookstores everywhere. If bookstores mm-hmm. existed, they would be sale. It's for sale
somewhere
everywhere.
In cyberspace, you can reach out and grab
exactly.
it.
Yeah. So get that book. And Ron, thanks for joining me.
Always good to be with you.
Let's have a wide-ranging conversation. We don't have the answers to everything, but I think we can put a lot of questions and issues on the table. But what happened on Tuesday? Where are we now? More broadly, we'll get to that. And then kind of where are we going? Mm-hmm. But what happened Tuesday? But someone comes down from Mars or has been away for 2 years and says, hey, what happened in this midterm election?
So in one sense, what happened Tuesday is what has been happening in midterm elections for quite some time. You know, assuming Republicans win the House, this will be the fifth consecutive time that a president went into a midterm with unified control of government and had the voters revoke it. Right. So it happened to Trump in 2018, Obama in 2010, W. Bush in 2006, Clinton in 94. No president since Jimmy Carter in 1978 has defended unified control of government through a midterm. And in one sense, the macro story that we are living through since the late 60s is the inability of either party to establish a durable advantage over the other, to an extent that we have not seen before in American history over a 50-year period. No one's had unified control of government for more than four consecutive years since 1968, and we've never gone 50 years where that's been true. So in one sense, you know, a shift toward the Republicans, a shift away from the party holding unified control is exactly what we've been experiencing in American politics for at least the last 40 years. But the nature of this shift was far different, as you know, than anyone expected. If you look at the exit polls and you look at the 75% of people who said the economy was bad or poor, roughly 55% disapproved of Joe Biden's job performance. The electorate was more Republican, tilted a little more Republican than it has been in the past. As one Republican consultant said to me today, every indicator on the dashboard was like pointing toward red wave. And we didn't get red wave. And I believe the reason we didn't is because this was what I have called a double negative election. You have that negative verdict on Biden's performance. No way arguing around that. It's 55% saying they disapprove of his job. And as I said, three quarters say the economy is doing badly. But those negative verdicts on what Democrats have done with power were bounded and limited by equal concern about what Republicans would do with power if given to them. And I think the 60%, roughly 60% in the exit poll said they had an unfavorable opinion of Trump. Clear majority wanted to keep abortion legal. And what Democrats were able to do was mobilize enough of their voters and hold far more independence than you would expect given the negative verdict on Biden by focusing their attention on issues like abortion, gun issues, and the threat to democracy that Trump and his movement present. And so you got an election that was much closer to a standoff than to the kind of rout that you would expect in a midterm where the president was in such a weakened position.
Yeah, that's a great summary. Someone said to me here last night up at Harvard for a panel this afternoon that he thought, I said history and gravity, like gravity that
yes.
pulls you down, argued for Republicans doing well, and they would have, except it was counteracted. He said he had a good formulation. History and gravity were counteracted by Trump and by the Dobbs decision.
Yeah.
How much of it do you think was Trump in particular, and secondly, abortion in particular? How much of it was a broader Trumpism, extremism, guns, a lot of stuff.
It's indistinguishable, right? It's one fabric. And basically, as Tom Bonier put it, who was a Democratic data guy, as well as my friend Ian Malika Henderson on CNN, I think they both belled the cat when they said that abortion was more than literally abortion. That was important by itself. But to the voters for whom it mattered, it became a symbol of a Republican Party that has become too extreme for them, particularly on social issues in the Trump era. And what we saw in every Senate race, I mean, every Senate race, was Democrats winning up 2/3 or more, usually 3/4. Sometimes Gretchen Whitmer won over 80% of voters who said abortion should remain legal in most or all cases. And I think that, you know, you can't untangle that from concerns about what the Trump movement means for American democracy. I mean, this is largely a national story, though with one important divide I'd like to get to in a minute. This is, you know, essentially a national story. The Democratic coalition, the anti-Trump coalition that turned out in 2018 and 2020, frayed around the edges largely because of inflation. Democrats did not do as well as they did in 18 and 20 among the groups at the core of that coalition, but they did well enough to hold down the losses and prevent this from becoming what it was expected to be. You see the fundamental cohesion of a coalition centered on young people, people of color, college-educated whites, secular voters, and women, especially across all of those categories, enough of that hold together. It frayed. It eroded. It didn't crumble, and that allowed them to put together a lot of surprises. Even while the other things were still there, right? I mean, it wasn't like discontent with Biden or unease about inflation went away. I mean, Republicans won some things, but the ability of Democrats to mobilize their coalition around these other issues in blue and purple states allowed them, as we're saying, to avoid the worst. And almost certainly they're going to hold the Senate, and the House could be astonishingly close, maybe decided by a pair of court decisions. You know, the New York Democratic-dominated highest court overturned a Democratic gerrymander, and the Republican-dominated state Supreme Court upheld an even more egregious gerrymander by DeSantis, and that might be the difference.
So in a way, if you step back and look at it, it is remarkable. You say the Democratic coalition altogether, but in general, things didn't change that much, right? Yeah. In a sense, I mean, this year will probably end up being plus, 0.4% or something in the Republican side for the whole national House vote. It was Democratic plus 2.5 in 2020. So it's a little erosion, as you'd expect, because in an off year against the party in power, but not so much. I think, and this is a question now on the groups that you focus so much on, college educated women as opposed to men, different Latinos and blacks and so forth. There's no huge change, is there? I mean, it looks sort of like each side's coalition looks very much like it did in 2020 and 2018, right?
Yeah, there's a, there are a lot of people who think the exit polls are not the end all be all. And eventually we will get other data from Pew and Catalyst that is also well respected. But at least in the exit polls, so where you're kind of comparing apples to apples, if you look versus 2020 or 2018, there's a consistent drop in the Democratic share among essentially every group, in their coalition, of about 7, 8, sometimes 10 points, I mean, so they took a hit in terms of, discontent over Biden and discontent over inflation. But they took a hit. They didn't collapse. And as I said,
but the relative share. I mean, the party looks, I guess each party looks the same.
It does.
Socioeconomically, racially, ethnically, educationally, as it did 2 and 4 years ago.
The idea of a vast realignment among Black and Latino voters that, Republicans and even some Democrats were touting, I mean, it didn't really happen. I mean, as I said, there's no group, I don't think there's any group we can identify where Republicans did not improve at least somewhat over 18 and 20. But of course, Democrats won the popular vote in both of those years by a lot. They had some margin to give. And there are two ways to look at what happened. I mean, from my point of view, You know, if you're talking about college educated women or Latinos or Black voters, certainly young voters, Democrats, as I say, eroded from 18 to 20, but they maintain substantial support. And I would, you know, my initial instinct is that if this is as far as you can get with 9% inflation and 55% disapproval of the sitting president, it may be hard to hold the level of support that you Republicans have. If this is as far as the tide extends, even with this, you know, these powerful forces behind it, it's easy to imagine those numbers would roll back at 3% inflation. You know, I mean, or a stock market that isn't, you know, walloping the 401ks of college educated people, or high interest rates that aren't frustrating young people trying to buy a house. You know, again, the Democratic coalition frayed under the pressure of all of those forces, but it largely held together. And to me, that says that if those forces recede, the coalition expands again. I mean, there is a coherent three elections in a row now, really four in 2016, but certainly the last three more. There is a coherent coalition that is adamantly opposed to the vision of America that Trump represents.
But here's the, I mean, the counter argument would be a little bit that the Republicans paid a huge price for the Trumpiest of the Trump candidates. If they can just dial that back some and not have Mastrianos of Pennsylvania. The fact is Florida, Ohio, and Iowa, the three of the swing states in 2000, 2004, and as late as, of course, 2012, won by Obama in the case of Florida and Ohio, are now excellent Senate campaign by Ryan in Ohio, and he's still, that's to say, just looks like it's just going to be Republican plus eight forever. Chuck Grassley's 89 years old. That looks like that's going to be Republican plus eight forever. And DeSantis runs up huge majorities in Florida. Now, other states have moved somewhat in a Democratic direction, but Arizona, which is one of the Sun Belt Democratic stars, suddenly is in a neck and neck race with Carrie Lake for governor. I don't know. You can make a case that the margin, I mean, both sides are sort of have things to point to that suggest, well, it's 50-50 or 51-49 or 52-48 nation. So, of course, both sides have things to point to where if only a few bad aspects of their narrative, as you say, in the Democratic case, inflation, interest rates, or in the Republican case, excessive Trumpiness got taken off the table, they could do better or no, or is it not quite as
No, it's a good point. I mean, if you're thinking about it in terms of just the total number of people in each coalition, I mean, the fact that the Democrats have won the popular vote in seven of the last eight presidential elections, which no party has ever done since the formation of the modern party system, suggests that it is a larger coalition in a presidential year when everybody votes. But obviously, that isn't always relevant to who wins the Electoral College, much less who controls the Senate and the House. If we're thinking about swing states and the Electoral College, there are 20 states now that have voted Democratic in at least the past four consecutive elections, and 20 states that have voted Republican in at least the past four presidential elections. That is a higher level of consistency, Bill. 80%, that means 80% of the states have voted the same way in every election since 2008. That's a higher level of consistency than even in the four elections that Roosevelt won. Right. So we have more states, a higher share of the states are locked. The only thing I could find that was like this was the three elections of the 1920s that the Republicans won. So we have an extraordinary level of, like, you know, 20 states on each side that are largely locked down with one exception. There are only 10 states that have voted for either side, you voted for both sides in the past four elections. And as you note, several of them really aren't swing states anymore.
Well, just on those 20 on each side, there are one or two exceptions, but the huge majority of those 20 in each case have governors from the party for which they voted for president, and two senators from the party from which.
Yeah. Democrats have 39 of the 40 senators in the 20 states they've won at least the last four times. And Republicans have 38 of the 40 in the states they won the last four times. But let me go back and finish because it goes to your point. So there are only 10 states that have switched at any point since 2008. And several of them really aren't swing states anymore. They were swing states under Obama and have kind of fallen off. And that includes Florida, Ohio, and Iowa. You know, North Carolina is kind of a swing state, but really at the edge. If we're talking about states that are genuine swing states at this point, we're talking about the five that switched from Trump in 16 to Biden in 20 and made him president. That's Arizona and Georgia, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, plus Nevada, maybe North Carolina, sort of. I'm not sure I'm missing anything.
And New Hampshire maybe on the other side, right? I mean,
New Hampshire maybe, but not, close.
Who knows?
Wisconsin's going to win by 10 points. And electing a governor is obviously something different. So if you look at the landscape, as you say, it's pretty clear from again, it was clear before, but now there's no question. Iowa and Ohio and Florida are really off the board for Democrats in 24. They are part of the Republican coalition. However, I would say if you look at the magnitude of the wins for Democrats in Michigan and Pennsylvania, I think there's an unequivocal signal that Trump or a very Trumpy candidate is going to have a very hard time in those states. I mean, Gretchen, we're talking about, again, 75% or more of people saying that the economy is poor, fair or poor, and a Democratic governor is going to win by like 10 points.
But a governor running for reelection in a state where abortion is literally on the ballot is
right.
A little different from the congressional races. So Pennsylvania was complicated to begin. Crazy.
The Democrats won the Senate race in Pennsylvania too. They won House races in both states. But what I was going to say was, I mean, I kind of think, and if I'm thinking about the states that are true, that seem truly, up for grabs equally between the two sides, maybe if there's not even a lean, let's give Michigan and Pennsylvania a Democratic lean.
Yeah,
we're not putting in the camp. But if I'm thinking about the states that are completely on the knife's edge, we're talking Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, and Wisconsin. I mean, that's it.
Right. It's amazing. And so from my point of view, I guess what strikes me as an anti-Trump Republican or ex-Republican is, shouldn't more people have been like appalled by it? It's sort of, I mean, you can say the Democratic, and you're right, the Democratic majority is a little bit larger and nationally, certainly presidential years, and a little younger, and, there's upside there, and the Republicans might have a tiny uphill, might be a little bit uphill. On the other hand, the stickiness of the Republican coalition
right.
is pretty amazing in a Trumpy world, and in a post Roe world where all the polling shows, better than 60-40 against the court decision and for relatively liberal abortion rights. And they still, including in states, like Iowa, I would guess. And
this is that little bookmark that I wanted to get back to. What's striking is that it's pretty clear that in blue and purple states, Democrats were able to mobilize a very energetic coalition, even amid the headwinds of economic discontent, around the idea that we have to mobilize to stop Republicans from banning abortion or rolling back other rights in the states, right? In Michigan and Pennsylvania. However, in the states where the Republican social conservative regime has actually been imposed since 2021, there was virtually no backlash. There was no ripple. I mean, Texas completely banned abortion. Florida, 15-week ban on abortion. Georgia, the 6-week ban on abortion. Iowa, Ohio, a very severe ban on abortion. And in all of those, Tennessee, the whole menu of abortion and LGBTQ stuff and classroom, don't say gay. Like, the menu that the red states have been pursuing include voting, abortion, transgender issues, limits on classroom speech, the don't say gay, limit on how you talk about sexual orientation. In the states that were actually doing this, the red states, there was no backlash. That was, Abbott won going away. DeSantis won going away. Democrats didn't even have a serious candidate in Tennessee. Kemp won by more than he did last time. And in a preview of what I'm writing next week, even in Georgia and Texas and Florida in the exit poll, a majority of voters said they wanted abortion to be legal in all or most cases, according to the exit poll. It was a lower percentage than in the, in the Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin. But among those who said abortion should be legal, a much higher percentage of them voted for the Republican governors who had moved to ban abortion.
Then, so DeSantis has accepted, for example, a 15-week ban
in
South Florida, which is much more liberal. I mean,
Abbott has a complete ban.
Yeah.
Wine and Kemp have 6-week bans, and they won a substantial portion of people who said abortion should be legal. And it goes to your point about the stickiness, right? I mean, in red states among conservative voters, even if they disagree with this, they were not getting off the team. They were not getting off the reservation. Whereas I think in blue states and purple states, there was a real unequivocal signal of like, don't bring this here. And I kept, I don't know. People might find this analogy, hysterical, but it reminds me a little bit of the 1850s where, it's not like slavery was unpopular in the South, but in the places that it had not extended to yet, it was fiercely resisted. And that's kind of like what I feel. I feel like we're watching very divergent systems, social systems develop between the red and blue states. And in this election, there was an opportunity for the red state voters to say, we don't want this. It's going too far. We don't want people carrying guns without permits. We don't want 6-week abortion bans. We don't want you telling teachers they can't talk about race or making it easier to ban books. And they didn't. That did not happen in the red states. But in the blue states or the purple and the purple states, the fear of that being imposed, I think, was very real and very powerful.
How much did candidates matter? Mitch McConnell famously spoke about candidate equality. In a couple of cases, it surely did in the yes. most extreme. But again, you're, to your point, though, at the end of the day, if someone had told you you'd taken vacation for 6 months, you had no idea who the nominees were in any of these states, and you had to predict the winners in the Senate races and even in the House races, and you were told that was going to be a level playing field, not a wave election, you would have predicted almost every state correctly, right? I mean, everyone thought Ryan ran a great campaign in Ohio and then loses by 8 points. I mean, but maybe at some level, does it matter to be a smart centrist Democrat who reaches out to Republicans as opposed to some, looking like you're out of touch?
Much like they say Lee Zeldin helped Republican House candidates in New York, Ryan clearly helped Democratic House candidates in Ohio, where they had a bunch of wins, including some takeaways.
And Shapiro in Pennsylvania, obviously.
Yeah, same thing. I think obviously the individual foibles and failures of the candidates mattered, but they were not like a random assemblage of people who got nominated. They got nominated because they embraced Trump and Trumpism. And Trump at that point had enough juice in the Republican coalition to force them, to have them win primaries. I mean, yeah, if you had Robeson, the more mainstream candidate in Arizona, against Katie Hobbs, who's a pretty weak candidate, I can't imagine it would be as close. And, would David McCormick have beaten John Fetterman? You can't guarantee it, but he probably would have run better than Mehmet Oz. But it's not like the part, it's not like it was just like, flipping a coin and you
right,
ended
right.
up, you ended up with Oz because of the reshaping of the Republican coalition under Trump to make it more Trumpy. I mean, I think more of the college educated, suburban, socially moderate, economically conservative voters who might have once thought of themselves as Republicans are probably wavering, at least north of the Mason-Dixon line. You continue and are thus less likely to be a force in the primaries. I mean, Republican Party got these candidates, not on a whim. They got them because Trump put his stamp on them, and enough Republican voters said that's good enough for me.
No, that's so important. I mean, in Arizona, in fact, the incumbent Republican governor who was popular, Doug Ducey, endorsed, I think, Robeson, right? I mean, Carrie Lake was, endorsed by Trump. And so, so that gets really to the core question going forward, right? Which is sort of the Trump, one of the questions many, it's a mistake to talk about the Republican Party ex-Trump, because what does that mean now? I mean, he's a huge part of it, and he'll be a huge part of it, even if he's not the nominee or if he blows it up on his way out, which we get to in a minute. But I do one last question just on the current coalitions, because I think it's so, I mean, you've made the point, I think it's a very important one, that we talk about things, states, because that's how votes get cast for Senate and governor and so forth, and so those are the governing entities. But of course, what the real distinction is more socioeconomic and education and race and all kinds of other things. And metro areas in red states look more like blue states. And one thing I think we've seen, do you think I'm right about this? The, let's call them the Trumpy areas in blue states seem to be becoming Trumpier. I mean, I kind of feel like there were parts of New York State that were held back from becoming like central Pennsylvania or Ohio, let's make a better comparison, because they were in New York somehow, and they were sort of residually still more liberal. But this sort of, they are now voting like they're similarly situated socioeconomic, educational achievement districts in Ohio, upstate New York and so forth. And I feel like, so I think in a way, the geographical, socioeconomic, educational sorting that you've written about so much and been so perceptive about, that's continuing, right? It's not reversing. It's not even, I think it might not even be stalling. It may even be getting more and more. But talk about that a bit.
The Trump coalition is a powerful coalition. It's stronger than I thought it would be. I mean, it's a little bigger than I thought it would be. And there's no question that what you're describing is true. I mean, we saw it in the Glenn Youngkin race. I mean, you know, in the previous governor race, like when Ed Gillespie in 2017 got into the 70s in these rural counties in Virginia, you're like, whoa. And then Youngkin got into the 80s in, you know, there does not seem to be a bottom for Democrats. I mean, I was reading a tweet stream thread from a woman who was running, I think, for state legislature in Missouri, and in a rural area, and describing her experience going door to door as a Democrat. And it was astounding what people were saying to her, you know. Yeah. I think that, you know, as I said, first of all, one of the lessons of 2022 is that these, with the exception of Georgia and Arizona, these red states are getting redder. I mean, you know, the Texas thing, the metros are clearly moving toward Democrats, but the rural thing is real. The Latino thing, it didn't really expand, but it's solid at 40% for them. The Trump coalition is a powerful coalition, and you know, the Democratic coalition is very powerful, and so we're kind of in this point where we have these two roughly even in size, but utterly antithetical in who they represent, what they value, and their vision of America, and trying to keep them both in the same country is just getting more and more difficult. I mean,
and then you think in the same state in some cases,
in the
because
same
presumably,
state, yeah.
I mean, yeah, you will see more mayors rebelling against governors and local officials and so forth, right?
Consistently Republican controlled state legislatures and governors overriding Democratic, limiting their powers of Democratic mayors and county executives. If you're in Austin or Houston and you look at the size of Abbott's victory after they imposed, am I right? It's a total ban on abortion in Texas, not even 6 weeks, it's a total ban. And he still wins over 60% of white women. Like, how do you kind of go forward from that? I mean, there's no way to look at this and say that, you know, basically red states are saying we're okay with this, you know, with what you're doing. And, whereas in Michigan and Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, and I'm betting if we had exit polls in Colorado and Washington, and even to a, you know, kind of a Arizona is kind of halfway between, you see the blue states very much saying no. I mean, Bill, given the ubiquity or the consistency of the negative views on the economy and the negative views on Biden, there is no other explanation for Democrat relative success in some of these states than a resistance to Trump and the Trumpism. There's nothing else. Well, what else would it be?
I mean, I think Dobbs is a little special. I take your point that it's part of a fabric. Literally, though, is overturning a 49-year decision that it by 5-4. I mean, it was a little bigger part of the fabric than critical race theory, or you know what I mean?
No, so right. Abortion becomes the kind of the focal point of it all. But the thing that to me is so striking is that the views on the economy were as negative in the states where Democrats did well as they were in the states that they did poorly. And that suggests that this other complex of issues, headlined by abortion, crystallized by abortion, symbolized by abortion, really, you know, I mean, you look, Whitmer won, according to the exit poll, 66% of college white women. She won 96% of black women. She won over 80% of voters who said abortion should be legal all or most of the time. And that was roughly what Shapiro got in Pennsylvania. And that is a majority in these states. I mean, I'm unaware of a state in the exit poll where a majority said abortion should be illegal in all or most circumstances. As I said, the difference is, first of all, the size of the group was smaller who said it should be legal in the red states. And even more importantly, fewer of those legal abortion voters voted against the Republican governors who, you know, signed laws to restrict it. If you think about where we are for 2024, you have to sort of project out two scenarios, one in which the economy gets better, and one in which it doesn't. If it doesn't, you know, Democrats will be under a lot of strain If it does, I would suspect their vote share will drift back up among all of the key groups in their coalition, because you won't have that headwind pushing, and you will still have a Republican social, cultural democracy agenda that frightens them.
Well, that's a key question about the Republican Party, and it's partly Trump specific and partly would go to the, whether DeSantis and Youngkin would have the same burdens. And I think a lot of it is abortion specific, in the sense that I think DeSantis, abortion barely came up in Florida. I don't know, DeSantis just kind of was able to say, if we have a law in the books, I'm for that law. And he never quite told pro-life voters that the law is 15 weeks, which allows 95% of abortions. And he never quite told pro-choice voters that in some theoretical way, he wasn't averse to making that 15-week limit lower. You know what I mean? He was able to get away with that. Could you do that at a national level is one point, one question. But just before, you've talked about before about the fact that in the past, a presidential approval was a very good predictor of vote in off-year elections in a state.
Yes.
And that this is the first time you've seen that it was less so this, that you had a lot of Biden, you've got some numbers on this, the Biden disapprovers voting for Democratic nonetheless.
So in 2018, Republicans lost all 10 Senate races in states where Trump's approval was at 48 or below. In 2010, Democrats lost 13 out of 15 states in the Senate where Obama's approval was at 47 or below. In 2006, Olympia Snowe was the only winner in 20 states where Bush's approval was at 45 or below. And here we have Democrats winning multiple states where Biden is closer to 40 than 45. I mean, they won Pennsylvania. Governor's a little different, but not that different. I mean, all of these states, his approval is in the low 40s. Arizona, Nevada.
So there's a decoupling from Biden.
There's a decoupling. Democrats won somewhere, multiple Democrats won between 12 and 15% of voters who disapproved of Biden. Maggie Hassan won 20% of voters who disapproved of Biden in New Hampshire. In 2018, just to give one example, there was no Republican Senate candidate who won more than 8% of voters who disapproved of Trump, right? And of course, people have really focused on the national exit poll as well, where the voters who said they somewhat disapproved of Biden actually broke slightly, or about even, they may have broken slightly for the Democrats. The voters who somewhat disapproved of Trump in 2018 voted 2-1 for the other party. The voters who somewhat disapproved of Obama in 2010 voted 2-1 for the other party. In 2006, I think it was 3-2. So the idea that these somewhat disapproving voters of Biden still voted Democratic is really a departure from what we have seen, in this, really since the 90s, of a tightening correlation between how voters feel about the president and how they vote in House and Senate races. And again, what can explain that? I mean, you can't explain it by saying these voters are more economically optimistic than anybody else. They weren't. The only thing that explains it is that Democrats succeeded in focusing at least some of them on the question of not only what Democrats have done, but what Republicans would do. And that allowed them to kind of, again, not avoid any losses, but really to create a much more even playing field than you would expect from the underlying economic attitudes and the attitudes about the president.
So if you're a Republican strategist, I think listening to this, you say, look, this isn't that complicated. We need to not renominate Trump. Maybe difficult, but it's not complicated. We need to not renominate Trump. We need to go federalist on abortion so we don't scare people in Michigan. You get to have your liberal abortion laws and amendments to your constitution, and other states will do other things. We need to lay off a little bit on the cultural grievances, though enough of it to keep the base happy. But, a lot of that's federal and local, state and local, and so we can sort of avoid it. So as a national matter, if we just get this Trump baggage off our back, can't we finally ride this coalition to an actual, not just electoral college, squeaker like in 2016, but an actual victory? Why is that A, semi-accurate as a theory, and B, could it happen in practice?
I mean, that is the best theory, right? I mean, that is the theory. And
can't happen with Trump as the nominee, can it?
Yeah. But even if Trump isn't the nominee, here's a question. I mean, as much a question for you as for me. Can someone win the nomination without signaling that they would sign a national ban on abortion?
Yeah, that is a big question, I think. I would say it would be risky, but if I were Ron DeSantis and wanted to be president, not just the Republican nominee, I would explicitly say it. I'm not sure Trump wouldn't then agree, because Trump is not deep down in his heart living and dying on the pro-life issue. but it would be a risky moment to try to kind of Clinton 92 no, almost moment to shift the party and make it acceptable. Moment.
Right,
a debate
Fox,
moment.
Fox is going to be everybody on this.
Mike Pence will attack you.
Sign a national ban on abortion. Raise your hand.
Yeah.
You know, and then they'll say, "Well, 15 weeks, rape, incest." Celinda Lake, you know, has been who is one of Biden's pollsters. You know, has made the point that she believes that's essentially irrelevant in maybe relevant in red states, but in blue states, it's essentially irrelevant. Like if
once you hear the word ban,
once you hear the word ban, that's it. And so if you are a strategist for DeSantis or Youngkin or someone, and by the way, I want to make a point about Youngkin, you would have to look at what happened yesterday in Michigan, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin and say, there's no other reason for us to not win these states other than voters viewed us as extremists, particularly on abortion, and to do exactly what you said. You have laid out what makes sense. I just don't know if they can get there, you know? And I do think what I was saying before, I won't put them entirely on one side, but I think if you have a Republican nominee who is running on any kind of national ban on abortion, I think yesterday tells me they are highly unlikely to win Michigan and Pennsylvania. Georgia, Arizona, Wisconsin, Nevada might be more, you know, still within reach. But I think it's pretty clear you are not going to win Michigan or Pennsylvania if you're saying we're going to ban abortion in your state under any 15 weeks with all sorts of exceptions. I don't think you can win. And I don't know if you can get the nomination without promising that now that it's at least possible to do because of the Supreme Court.
And what about Trump himself? I mean, how big, yeah. I mean, the fact yeah. is he, how much you buy the line that he's weakened in intra-Republican politics by what happened Tuesday with the Trumpiest candidates underperforming, I think it's fair to say, Mastriano, et cetera, and DeSantis's huge victory in what was a swing state in quite recently in Florida and so forth. I mean,
so a couple points on Trump. First, I think to what you kind of alluded to, there were Trump chosen, hand selected, you know, he put the T on their head in all five states that switched from Trump 16 to Biden 20, Arizona, governor and Senate, Georgia, Senate, Wisconsin, governor, Michigan, governor, Pennsylvania, governor, and senator. And out of that whole list, the only ones who have a chance to win probably at this point are Kerry Lake in Arizona and maybe Herschel Walker in Georgia. And none of them are guaranteed. If a rational party would look at that and say, that's a pretty clear signal that if we come back with Trump himself or even someone really in the mold of Trump, these states are going to be hard. Now, the problem Republicans have is that their nomination rules are very different than the Democratic nomination rules for the president. And they really favor the candidate who has the largest block of the party. And it's worth taking a second to explain this. Republicans have much more winner-take-all features in their nominating process where if you finish first in a CD, even if you only get 35% of the votes, you get all the delegates from that CD. Or if you finish first in a state, you get bonus delegates. I don't know if they have any left. They used to have more states. If you finish first in a state, you get all the delegates in the state. I don't think they do that, but they have bonuses. When Trump was the presumptive nominee in 2016, before he had reached 50% in any state, people forget that. He didn't reach 50% in any state till New York at the end of April, at which point he was already the presumptive nominee. At that point, he had only won about 40% of the total vote, and he had pulled away from the field, right? So the question is, Trump is weaker than he was when he left office, and he's weaker today than he was a week ago. But is there anyone who has as big a piece? Like, is his share of the Republican primary electorate still somewhere in the 40 to 45% range? If it is, it gets really hard to beat him. And this is where Youngkin comes in, okay? Because if Youngkin runs, he's not gonna be the nominee. I mean, the party, you play this back at me in 2 years, but I think it's highly unlikely Youngkin would be the nominee. What Youngkin can do, however, is siphon off a lot of the college-educated voters who are least likely to support Trump and lead them into an absolute dead end where they can't be part of an actual winning coalition to beat him. People forget that in 2016, even in 2016, when he won the nomination so convincingly, he only won about 35% of college-educated Republicans. He won like 55, 58% of the non-college Republicans. The only one, the college Republicans did not want him even then. The problem was, as you know, painfully, they just kind of went everywhere, a little bit to Kasich, a little bit to Rubio, a little bit to Cruz. And Youngkin could win a lot of them, but I don't see him winning enough of the non-college and evangelical to ever be the nominee. And so what he could do is simply divert a critical part of the anti-Trump coalition into a dead-end candidacy that would leave Trump's 55%, which he's still getting in polls, by the way. He's still getting 55% of non-college Republicans. That could be a winning hand if you're trying to, you know, beat him, and Youngkin is siphoning off a big piece of the rest.
I mean, I guess the question is, can Ron DeSantis clear the field? Not immediately, they'll all want to test it, but by November of 2023, it's going to be DeSantis and Trump, or someone else in Trump, but I mean, the field gets narrowed to two or three. A, B, can that candidate say, look, we just got to win. Trump, fine, good presidency, a lot of good policies, but the election denial stuff's a killer, and the baggage, other kinds of baggage from his years in office and post and the lawsuits and so forth and indictments is a killer. And I'm here. I'm not some horrible anti-Trumper like Liz Cheney. I'm not some person who, you know, thinks you're deplorable for having voted for Trump. I voted for Trump twice. I like former President Trump. We just can't go down that road again. I guess that's the question, right? Is that message, assuming Trump runs?
Like the other thing, like your analysis of the general election, I could imagine that working. I mean, I can imagine that working. But there are problems with it. One, as I said, is that the core of the anti-Trump, the Republican primary is now roughly 50-50 college and non-college. And the college side is definitely the core of the anti-Trump resistance in the party to Trump. And can anybody consolidate that better than we saw in 2016? And then the second thing I would point out is that the rules benefit whoever has the biggest piece. So that is a real challenge. If he can hold his non-college side, he may have the biggest piece in a lot of places. The third problem is, you know, we'll call it the Mike Tyson rule. You know, everybody has a plan until they get punched in the face, right? The famous Mike Tyson quote. Running against Trump cannot be fun. I mean, he is, you know, shameless and uncontained, unbounded. And, no one handled it very well in 2016. I mean, he reduced Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, and Ted Cruz to little puddles. You know, I mean, they were, Rubio and Cruz still seem broken by the experience. You know, I mean, it was like something out of Game of Thrones, you know. I don't know how anyone can stand up to, I don't know until you see it, how they will stand up to that. You know, is DeSantis capable of going toe to toe with Trump for a year?
That's a key question for people to focus on, though. And as you said, I think it's important to make that point about the actual toe to toe character of it, not just a theoretical, you know, here's my sketch of the idea of Ron DeSantis. Here's my sketch of the idea of Donald Trump. And hey, the idea of Ron DeSantis could do better. That's not how voters are going to process it, right? So,
And of course, you also have the question of whether Trump would sabotage someone who beats him,
right?
And the principle you laid out, the principle argument that would, you know, be implicit in any movement against Trump for the nomination, which is not, you can't run and say he was a bad president or he's a threat to American democracy, because only about 20 to 25% of Republicans believe he is in any way a threat to democracy. You have to be positive toward him, but essentially imply that he can't win. Well, what if, like, he's basically holding the whole party hostage and he basically turns it around and say, you know what, if you don't nominate me, you can't win, because I'm taking my marbles and going home, or I'm running a third party candidate, or I'm going to go out and trash you as a heretic. I mean, he could turn that around.
No, I think this is an important point. Andy Zwick and I were talking about this earlier. I mean, Trumpism is a problem. So from my point of view, it's a serious problem in terms of American democracy and all. It's a problem electorally to some degree, as we were just saying, in these states. But Trump personally is a problem that people haven't, you know, they acknowledge it in passing, but then if you're sort of in the game of political strategy, you kind of want to get beyond that. So you start talking about Youngkin and DeSantis and the different issues. You don't think about concretely in the real world, what is Donald Trump going to be like for the next 20?
And by the way, we should probably say the situation isn't exactly, sunshine and roses on the other side either.
Well, let's talk about that. So what do you think? Biden, again,
Well, I think, well.
And what do you think the effect of Tuesday is?
Well, first, I mean, you know, the Tuesday effect is the dog that doesn't bark, right? Because if they had a really bad midterm, there would be an instant eruption of people saying Biden has to step aside. And we're not going to get that. We're not going to get nearly as organized a push against him as we would have seen if it had been a really bad election for Democrats. But you can't ignore that in the, you know, in the exit polls, 55% disapproved of his job performance and 2/3 of people said he should not run. I got the numbers. I don't remember them exactly. The number is even higher among independents. I think it's closer to 3/4 of independents. Now, all of this may prove irrelevant.
That's 2/3 of all voters, though, not of
Democrats. 2/3 of all voters and maybe 3/4.
But it must be, therefore, some chunk of Democrats who's saying Biden shouldn't run, right?
Yeah. You know, if we weren't on camera, I would get my phone and I could actually tell you the number.
People can look it up.
You can look it up. No, it hasn't been published. So I would be giving you the crystal inside exclusive on how many Democrats said Biden shouldn't run again.
Once we put the conversation up online, you can tweet it out as a supplement.
I will tweet it out. So, but there are two big buts here. One, as Biden said yesterday, so what? I don't really care. You know, I mean, he said that. And I do think people in the White House overwhelmingly believe that Biden considers it his final mission in American politics to prevent Donald Trump from destroying American democracy, which he believes that he would do, you know? And I think as long as he considers it a possibility that Trump will run, it is going to be very hard to convince him not to run. A very senior official explained to me that the way I just formulated it is wrong. It's backwards. It's not that he's going to run if Trump runs. It's that he has decided to run because he believes Trump will already run. And if Trump doesn't run, maybe then he'll reconsider it. But the supposition is that he's running, the stipulation is that I'm running unless something changes. It's not that I'm waiting to see what Trump does. Now, you know, another reason for Biden to run, and I was talking about this with a Democrat yesterday, was, you know, what happens if he doesn't? You know, clearly there is no wide belief in the party that Harris can win, you know, but she is the first woman of color, a vice president, and there would be substantial support for her in the primary and bypassing a black woman to nominate probably a white candidate is a very messy prospect for Democrats. I mean, you know, you could look at yesterday, and I look at yesterday or Tuesday, and, you know, Gretchen Whitmer seems like a pretty
compelling. Can we just have the Whitmer Shapiro ticket and just like go home and, you know?
Well, I don't think we can have Whitmer Shapiro. I don't think we're going to have two white governors from the.
But I'm saying, but something like that. You know what I mean?
Well, you know, maybe.
Can we have voters, candidates who actually have won swing states by big margins and just kind of.
If you didn't have to worry about losing the Senate seat, there are many Democrats who feel like Whitmer Warnock would be, a great ticket. How do you get there? Right. How do you get there? I mean, how do you get, even if Biden doesn't run, can you get past the first female woman of color vice president? And even if you get past her, you got Buttigieg and Warren. I mean, I think there are a lot of Democrats. You were talking about, you know, the on paper versus the reality of dealing with Trump. I mean, there are a lot of Democrats who desperately want what Biden said to be true in Michigan right before the pandemic shut everything down. I am the bridge, the next generation. Look at these people behind me. And that included Whitmer and Cory Booker. Like, that's not a bad ticket, I suppose. Yep. No. Yep. But how do you get there in practice?
And I think it's less personally. I think Harris, you could get. I mean, she's vice president. She's titled to run. She will run. Some blacks will support her. Some blacks won't support her, as happened in 2020, obviously. But it's more almost just the messiness of, okay, then we've got 12 candidates, and some of them are very impressive. I would make the case it's quite a strong bench by historical standards in American politics, that if you walked into a room and had a conversation with Whitmer, Shapiro, Buttigieg, Warnock, you know, just go through a whole bunch of Jared Polis, there'd be some pretty impressive governors, some pretty impressive members of Congress. Mitch Landrieu can show up, having been mayor of New Orleans. I mean, but yeah, how do you get from here to there once, you know, how do you not have...
to there? Yeah. I mean, I do think that the desire for There was a dramatic age break in the results everywhere yesterday. I mean, Democrats did much better among people 18 to 44 than among 45 plus. And, you know, it may seem incredible, but the oldest millennials are now 41. The oldest millennials will be 43 in the 2024 election. So that is the base of the party. And the idea that you have a party that is essentially centered on young, diverse, secular America, metro, info age America, is led by a bunch of octogenarians in every sphere is kind of crazy. I mean, you know, it would be electrifying, I think, for the actual Democratic coalition if you could get to a younger nominee ticket that, you know, would excite people and reflects the changing America. And Harris does that. I mean, I don't know, could she be the vice president again, you know, if Biden doesn't run? But like, how do you get there? I mean, how do you get there?
I mean, a lot will happen. So that might help get us there or not. I mean, that's, I think people have A.B. Stoddard made this point on a conversation about 3 months ago. People are underestimating how crazy 2023 can be. We tend, when we're in the election business, we of course think from 22 to 24. Yeah. We know there are primaries, so we think about the beginning of 24. And then we think about presidential candidates. I mean, what will happen if Republicans have a very narrow margin in the House, which looks like the most likely outcome now, but I mean really narrow, 3-4 seats, something like that margin. I mean, the degree of difficulty of managing that, the craziness that voters will see from the Marjorie Taylor Greens of the world, who I don't think will be restrained, Trump butting in every time McCarthy tries to do something, or just to get publicity, or if he doesn't like something McCarthy's doing, or he encourages Jim Jordan. Why aren't the hearings of Hunter Biden begun yet? Come on, Jim Jordan, I want them now. And Jim Jordan will hop to it, I guess. I mean, just that side of it, the actual, on the other hand, hearings about Hunter Biden could be embarrassing. I don't know. I just wonder, Trump could get indicted. There could be demonstrations against Trump being indicted, and the House can impeach Merrick Garland. I just think people are not like focused on what we're going to go through here.
So, like this, and you know, I apologize for coming back to this because I'm, you know, working it out and writing it now, and so it's, you know, top of mind. But like the idea of Republican extremism and Trumpism as a threat to fundamental principles of American democracy and civil rights and civil liberties is really powerful in blue states and bluish states. It does not seem to be at all nearly as much of a turnoff for any portion of the Republican coalition in the red states. I mean, they're not, there's just nothing, there's, you know, maybe suburban Atlanta, above putting that in a purple state, you know, is they stayed off the bus, you know, for Walker. They would not follow him. But in the blue states and the purple states, again, I keep coming back to this. What else can explain Democrats doing reasonably well amid this economic discontent? And so what you're positing is an entire year of showing those voters over and over again what it would mean to give Republicans power. Because again, I think the pivot in this election was that midterms normally are what their referendum, what is the party in power done with that power? That did not disappear. That was a factor, but this was bounded and limited by the Democrats' success at introducing the second question: what would Republicans do with power? And the 2023, you know, cavalcade is going to really put that in relief.
And it will be fair to say in 2024, if we've gone through a 2023 something like this. I mean, it will be popular in red states, perhaps, and even in reddish parts of blue states, which matters for the House because they get elected by district, not by state, right? So, I mean, they won't be paying a price necessarily. At least Stefanik's not going to get unseated, even though she's from New York, if she's at the head of the Hunter Biden, you know, prosecution parade or something, or the Merrick Garland impeachment parade. But I do think one thing about 24 I was just thinking about and that hasn't been focused on is Democrats will be able to say truthfully in 24, if you elect a Republican president, they're not going to lose the House, presumably, if they win the presidency.
That's back. Right.
And the Senate map is such that they have a very good chance of, even if it's a 51-49 Senate going into 24, winning the Senate. So you really are risking unified Republican governance.
Yes.
And are you willing, it's one thing to have that in a pre-Dobbs world where Trump can, you know, insincerely talk about rights of life and that he can make judicial appointments, which have an effect ultimately, but short, medium term, it has no effect on anything. And in a lot of things world, That stuff was just beginning, a lot of the culture war stuff, or not beginning, but hadn't been intensified yet. It was more random comments of Trump, not actual, lists of books being banned. Uh-huh. I mean, I do think it's interesting how much, maybe that just rallies Blue America.
That's right.
Which is important.
I mean, that's what I believe. I think the message of Tuesday is that you can mobilize the states that are, the blue states, plus Michigan and Pennsylvania and maybe Wisconsin. You can mobilize them out of opposition to what a Trump vision of America would mean for that state. And you can mobilize them around preventing Republicans from getting the power to impose that vision.
If Democrats don't present candidates who really look themselves, excessively problematic. I mean, there was a gap between Evers and even Mandela Barnes, who's not, personally right. objectionable like Walker or anything, but it's just has more left wing yeah. baggage.
Yeah. And also we're not in a recession. I mean,
right.
I mean, obviously, although I wouldn't say that, like, even if, right. I don't know how much higher economic discontent can be than 75%. So I'm not even sure if the economy stayed bad. I'm not sure Biden couldn't beat Trump. He might not be able to pass, but I think I don't rule it out. Yeah. I mean, Biden could beat Trump with a 45% approval rating. I mean, that could happen.
Unless the Biden age thing becomes enough of a disqualifier to actually shake swing voters away in a way that I could argue, your Whitmer, Warnock ticket wouldn't. I mean, that is to say, or your Shapiro someone ticket or something.
All right, I'm crawling out on a limb here. I think if Trump is the nominee, it almost doesn't matter.
Yeah,
The only issue for the coalition that came out to oppose him in each of the past three elections will be stopping him from being president. And, there could be an eggplant at the top of the ticket now, and you would have a kind of battle of the bulge in which I'm not saying it's guaranteed that he would lose. I'm saying for that coalition, nothing else is likely to matter. Nothing like, the inflation level, the stock market, it's not going to matter as much as whether you want to let him have power and potentially change the character of American democracy forever. And for his coalition, the opportunity to do that is going to be very enticing. But the more I think about it, I just can't imagine. I mean, I don't know. I don't think there is a higher level of economic discontent than 75-80%.
Well, but only a 3.5% unemployment. So there was objective facts that sort of made the discontent slightly abstract,
so I would put it. Inflation is real.
But inflation was real. I agree.
If J.P. Morgan is right, and we have 3.2% inflation with 5% unemployment a year from now, Biden's approval almost certainly is going to be a few points higher than it is today. And the Democratic situation will look a little better. And as I was saying before, one way to think about what happened on Tuesday is, yes, the Democrats lost ground in every group they rely on compared to 18 and 20. They held together enough of it to avoid a shellacking, but they did lose ground with everybody. So do you look at that and say, well, there's some secular trend that is moving these people more toward Republicans? Or do you say, even with 9% inflation, this was as far as the tide got, this is as far as they got. And if it's 3% inflation, they're likely to, the tide is likely to roll back out, a few yards.
But it's only a few yards either way, right? That's what's so striking. Your Democratic legislator running in Missouri, and this is, finding out, just saying the word Democrat and suddenly they're not interested. Missouri was once something of a swing state and part.
I went to Sheryl Crow's hometown with Claire McCaskill once when she was running against Jim Talent. I've been to the Sheryl Crow Aquatic Center.
Wow.
Yeah. I've talked about it with her once. That was.
Wow. Okay. Now we're really name dropping and stuff,
Yeah, a little celebrity name dropping,
That's good.
I do have this whole other side, thinking about
culture
and politics intertwined.
And of course, in the era of Trump, we shouldn't minimize the importance of celebrities. I think you're very, it's a very interesting question. I don't know if, how much Trump, if he runs, assuming he probably will, whether or not he's the nominee, I would almost say, but especially if he's the nominee, of course, how much the next 2 years of American politics, the central figure is Donald Trump, right? I mean, for all the drama and people like us care a lot about the House and the Democratic candidates and the President of the United States, Joe Biden, and these interesting younger, Josh Shapiro. Wow, look at that, a Democratic governor of Pennsylvania who's, winning by 16 points or whatever he won by. and DeSantis on the other side. The dominance of Trump, the centrality of Trump is kind of amazing, actually.
It is. Look, there is a coherent, durable coalition that has shown it will come out to vote to prevent Trump from imposing his vision on America. Now, whether that is enough to win always is, you know, is a question. I mean, obviously in 2016, there were more people who voted against him than for him, but it wasn't enough to win because of the rest. I'm not guaranteeing that he is going to lose if he runs in 2024. What I'm saying, though, is that there is a coherent coalition that is dead set against, you know, what people describe it, Democrats call it the anti-MAGA majority. And that will come out in 2024, even if we're like in Carter level stagflation. Because, you know, there are enough voters, which what last night made clear was that there are a lot of voters. There are a lot of voters who view that as an existential threat that go beyond anything that's happening in the immediate, you know, kind of biosphere, you know, of their lives. Again, not guaranteed that it is a winning hand, but I think it is almost independent of where Biden is and where the economy is. Now, obviously, you get people who are not really part of that discussion on board if the economy is better. I mean, so it gets a little bigger, but there is a core that could win even in a bad economy. Not guaranteed, but it could.
Yeah, and I suppose the sort of flip side of that is that the Trump is so well identified as a person and with issues that he can't really do what candidate, you know, moderate, pull a click, you know, he can't sort of, that election denial stuff, I don't quite mean that. Now, whether another Republican could, and that's, we discussed that earlier, is I think a very interesting question, because presumably if he sheds some of that election denial, anti-democratic stuff, could have an awful lot of stuff that you wouldn't like, frankly, and I wouldn't like, of, you know, culture war and grievance politics, but that would be a little less scary to people. Little federalism on abortion, and suddenly things change enough, you know, for 1 or 2 or 3% in the key states.
You know, Biden would be 81 on election day, almost 82. There's a slice of this anti-Trump coalition that is really not that, you know, enthused about Democrats.
Yeah. People
focus on, how Republican, self-identified Republicans are sticking with the MAGA candidates. And that's true. But there's no way Democrats are running even among independents or winning independents in states like Arizona and New Hampshire in this climate, unless there are some people who used to think of themselves as Republicans who are voting Democratic. I mean, Mark Kelly won independents by a substantial margin in the exit poll. And those are people who are, you know, they might call themselves independents, but they're functionally, a lot of them are functionally Republicans in the past. So, you know, if you gave them a better alternative, you know, we saw that with Kemp. I don't have the exit poll in front of me. I'm guessing Kemp won independents and Walker lost them.
And it's so dramatic that Kemp is not on the list of people spoken about for president when he's a successful Republican governor in a swing state who upheld the 2020 election. So he's not an election denier, but is otherwise very conservative. But somehow he's not, having taken on Trump in 2020, same with Pence, incidentally. That for me is very revealing. Now, if one of them could take off, that sort of is maybe where the party can be, because Kemp and Pence in sort of different ways are the Trump policies without the election denial and too much conspiratorialism and craziness. Pence has an issue. Pence is so pro-life, that would be a complication. But Kemp and Pence are not in the top tier, right? I mean, DeSantis swamps them in the polls because he plays the grievance politics, presumably.
Yeah. You know, right. I mean, Kemp has implemented...
And never took on Trump. That's the key, right? Both Pence and Kemp said to Trump, sorry, no can do when it came to overturning the 2020 election. It's amazing that's so central, really. Isn't that kind of crazy? I guess
it's just a proxy for loyalty to Trump, deference to Trump. That's what it is. And... you know, there is a, the idea that many non-college and non-urban and evangelical voters think that he is their voice against the elites and he's given them a voice that they haven't had, a megaphone they haven't had, that isn't aimed just at Democrats. That's also aimed at Republicans, right? So he would have, I think, enormous success at essentially saying he could have enormous success at saying these candidates are trying to put you back in the shadows, you know, in the corner, and I am your champion. And all of these people, you know, look down on you and they just want to go back to their boardrooms. And, you know, I'm the one out here fighting for you. I don't think his hold on non-college Republicans is going to be seriously dislodged. And I will point out again that even in 2016, only a little less than two thirds of college Republicans did not want him. And that didn't work to stop him.
Yeah.
So someone has to figure out a way to both consolidate a little more of the college Republicans and cut in a little more deeply to his hold on the non-college Republicans than anybody was managed to do in 2016. And maybe DeSantis can do that. Maybe he can compete on both sides. As you say, he has the grievance politics that may pull away some of those blue collar Republicans, but he also seems to be a little more acceptable to the boardroom Republicans. But we'll see. I mean, I can imagine it. I, sitting here, playing it out, we can both imagine it. But then you got the Mike Tyson rule, you know? I mean, like, everybody's got a plan until they get punched in the face. And so, like, you and I sitting here on the Zoom are not going to actually have to go out and do it day after day.
No, that's so important, interesting. Well, we need to get back together in a few months and see where we stand. And there's an awful lot's going to happen, right? I mean, we'll see who they do. Do they really take the House? Is it close enough that someone pointed out today on Twitter, very obvious but intelligent, good point. If it's literally 219 to, what would the math be? Or 218 to 219 to 14, 16, or 220, 250. I mean, people retire, people have illnesses. President Biden appoints some Republican, finds one Republican who wants a good job somewhere, you know, gives him a job and he leaves the House and it's an open seat. I don't know. It's not obvious that could be so crazy and so chaotic.
I don't think there's enough anti-Trump. The only impeachment Republican was the guy in Washington.
Yeah, Dan Newhouse, I think, who was still there. But leave that aside, but I just think generally
that was still there. If Kinzinger had not retired and he was the last vote, you're making him an ambassador and suddenly, you know, Nancy Pelosi is speaker again.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I don't know if they can find
that. My other point is we sort of got used to it.
Your point is, I talk about your point is really important because assuming they do get a House majority, 2023 is going to be broadcast to this coalition in blue and purple states exactly what they have to look forward to if Republicans get unified control. And I just think that could be very difficult in at least some of them. I mean, I think DeSantis could win back Arizona or Georgia. I do think that. I don't think he can win. I would be surprised if he could win back Michigan and Pennsylvania in the shadow of unified Republican control based on what we saw Tuesday. I'm like really crawling out on a limb here, but I feel like, I just keep going back to this point. People are so unhappy with the economy and they still elected Democrats by pretty big margins in those states, which says to me that they really don't want the kind of Trump/red state regime being imposed on them. And if you have a 2023 that is constantly broadcasting what that might look like, I think that'll make it very hard, at least in those two states, with Arizona, Georgia, Nevada, and Wisconsin, on the other hand, being really just, you know, total tipping point. Democrats, by the way, I think I calculated this morning, if you take out Nevada and give them the other 19 states they've won four straight times, add Michigan and Pennsylvania, Democrats, it's 260 to 235 at that point.
For the Democrats. So they only need one more state.
They need one more state. They would need one out of Wisconsin, Georgia, and Arizona. You know, I hesitate to even say North Carolina because they're not going to win North Carolina before they win one of those.
Right. Interesting. Well, we're already speculating about the 2024 Electoral College, so we probably have a few things to get to before then. But anything we haven't covered here that people should be just looking for over the next few months and years? I come back to the centrality of Trump. I mean, does he get indicted? Does he run? Does he? Who runs against him?
Yes.
That seems
he gets indicted. Yes, he runs. Someone's going to indict him. He's going to get indicted by Georgia or the Justice Department. And of course, the Justice Department might indict him twice.
Yeah.
For classified and for obstruction of the 2020 count. So You know, I think he, I don't, you know, and in some ways that makes him harder to beat, I think.
Yeah, because in a Republican primary. What is Ron DeSantis going to say the day Donald Trump gets indicted for keeping classified documents at Mar-a-Lago? He's not going to say, you know, Justice Trump might have a good case here. And I don't think he's even going to say, let's withhold judgment and let the court process work. I think he's going to say, don't you think every Republican is going to be under massive pressure to say this is an outrage?
Yeah, no.
And then they're,
they have chosen to put themselves under his thumb. They've had infinite opportunities to pursue an off-ramp in which, you know, just to pursue an off-ramp. And each time they have basically said, they made the calculation that it's too risky, too big a risk of alienating his voters. We like his superpower of turning out those voters. We don't want to give that up. And they won't do it. And so here they are.
So you predicted Biden-Harris in 2018, so I can't resist this midterm. You can duck it if you want, obviously, but and you and I were joking earlier, if you did a matrix, you know, there are four possible ways, leaving aside third parties, 2024 could happen. Could be Biden versus Trump.
Right.
Non-Biden versus Trump. Non-Trump versus Biden. And non-Trump versus non-Biden, right? Those are there aren't infinite possibilities of how this can work out. I take it from our conversation that you're sort of the most likely of those four you think is Biden versus Trump.
Yeah, yeah.
By a considerable margin.
Which would be 160 years of candidate, by the way.
Right. And Biden will be Harris, so we'll have three of the four will be a repeat of 2020.
If Lake wins, I mean, you know, she would seem to
be. So Biden, Harris, Trump, Lake. That's the official Brownstein Crystal Conversations midterm projection.
You're making a persuasive case that Trump can be beat. You know, I mean, I don't know who DeSantis. DeSantis is the only one who's going to beat him. If anybody does.
Unless some weird. I don't know. Who knows? But it's
who would be the DeSantis vice president? Would be a senator. Right. So
I guess I don't know.
Stefanik
or something. I don't know. But
it would be someone from Congress,
I would think. Although who knows? Maybe these old rules are totally off the. I think as we're speaking on Thursday afternoon, the 10th, we don't know what's happening in the Arizona governor's race, which looks dead even. I think that's kind of a final point. We should let you go and let people go. I mean, I think Lake winning helps take the edge off the disastrous night for Trump narrative. Yeah. Like losing really means all the Trump blessed, almost all except for J.D. Vance, I guess, Trump blessed candidates in swing states have lost. If Lake wins, then Trump gets a little bit of, see, when they were really good candidates like me, whom I blessed, they did fine. And Arizona was the place they said we couldn't win and, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So place that they stole from him. They stole from him in 2020, you know, that's what that audit showed and stuff. So Lake is a weirdly big figure.
He'll find a silver lining, and her winning would be, I mean, look, she's running against a weak candidate with 9% inflation, and she might eke it out by, you know, a tiny margin. It's incredible that that's happening. And it's only happening because there are so many Republicans willing to vote for someone who is an open election denier, who wants to defy federal law on immigration and all that. But again, like, does that say, it doesn't say to me that Arizona is Republican leaning in 24. It says it's just right. You know, I assume the underlying climate for Democrats will be better in 24 than it was in 22, that the tide will roll back a little bit unless Biden is so obviously incapable of running that people recoil against that. And I suppose that's like a circuit breaker. It's like it's self-correcting. If he's obviously incapable of running, he won't be the nominee.
Yeah. So that would be then. And then the Democrats will either produce an excellent nominee against Trump or have a terrible primary process that gets everyone both annoyed at each other and alienates swing voters. I don't know. It's hard to know how that.
I mean, I think they would, the best thing they could do, clearly the best thing they could do would be Biden and Harris to both step aside and nominate one of these governors.
Yeah.
That would be the best thing they could do. I'm not sure they can get there even if Biden and Harris step aside. I mean, I think it might be hard. You and I might say, you know, Gretchen Whitmer and Wes Moore and Gavin Newsom and people like that are really potentially very compelling general election candidates. It's going to be hard to get past Buttigieg and Warren.
Yeah.
And if Biden and Harris step aside, like they would be pretty formidable.
They could be good candidates too. Who knows? Buttigieg could be, I think, but I don't know. Who knows? But
yeah. Buttigieg, you know, Buttigieg.
Generational change.
Yeah. But I mean, it's, you know, I think.
Big gamble.
it's a big gamble. I mean, he's a gay guy, and he's never held an executive office. He's never been, he's been, now I guess he's transportation secretary and, the mayor, but doesn't have a lot of global experience. And, I actually think people would pay. I mean, I think he could hold up against, I think he could pass the Mike Tyson test, actually.
Yeah.
I think he could really do well in the actual give and take with Trump every day. I mean, he would, and, and I don't know how Whitmer would do in that, or Newsom. I mean, don't rule out Newsom. Newsom is the one who has most directly stepped into the void that, Biden doesn't really want to, and he did it, he does at times, but he doesn't really want to confront the extent of the aggressive moves in the red states. And Newsom found a market opening and filled it.
Yeah. And that will happen, I'm sure, repeatedly over the next months and year, because politics is not a static thing. And so people should discount some of what we're saying. It's a snapshot of, I think, a good snapshot in Thursday.
We should say before we go, I mean, the fact that Abbott, Kemp, DeSantis, Reynolds, et cetera, Lee in Tennessee, all got reelected is not exactly to discourage them from going further on all of these fronts.
Right, right.
You can see quite a bit more. In the coming year, particularly on education and speech and parents and stuff like that.
Yeah, a lot of stuff's going to happen on different states and both sides. You never know also which particular thing catches on nationally and so forth. Yeah. So, right. I mean, so Ron, thank you very much for joining me today on the Thursday after Election Day for really an interesting, not recap so much as where we are and where we're going and where we might be going.
Yeah.
I think so. Hopefully we'll destroy the parts of this, later on that don't come true and keep
the other parts. Can we call it a pre-cap?
It's a pre-cap. Yeah.
This is a pre-cap.
But I do think, look, it's been very interesting and stimulating. And just in this conversation alone, just two or three things occurred to me that I hadn't really thought as much about before. So this was for me very useful. And
same here.
Thank you for doing it. And thank you all for joining us on Conversations.